Good evening. James McCanny here with My Science Hour. It is March 23rd, 2017. Many topics to cover tonight. A couple political items. They might be political, but really cross over into an area in which I would claim to be an expert, which is spying, encryption codes, the methods by which hacking is done and eavesdropping, etc. James Comey, this past week, head of the FBI, really dodged some very strange bullets. And I listened to his testimony, and he's doing the same thing he did during the Clinton investigations, where he's just sidestepping reality. It's very clear that there's only a couple people in the government, a handful, a literal handful, maybe less than, they say less than 300, but it's down to literally about 9 now, so less than 2 hands of fingers worth of people who could have leaked the information about Flynn and the other conversations. And therein lies the real problem. You have people who have access to eavesdropping who then are using it for political purposes. And do they do this? Well, yeah, it's done all the time. Did Obama authorize this? Well, no, it's like asking if Tony Blair authorized murders of blacks in South Africa. No. You know, they don't directly do this. They have people that are in charge of this, and that's what they do. They do this all the time. That's their job. That's what they do. The CIA's job, it really isn't their job. I don't even know if they have a job description. But they go into foreign countries, and it's well known that hundreds of elections have been influenced by the CIA. You see it all the time in Latin America, in other countries, in Europe. Right now they're messing with the European elections that are going on, and just recent elections, etc. Or in political efforts, whether it's to control water in Ireland, whether it's to control the installation of wind generation power that doesn't work in the Netherlands or in Germany, or, you know, they have their fingers in everything, forcing countries to comply with NASA regulations, whatever it is. But here's the bottom line and the real problem, that once the security state begins, then other countries have to follow suit as a defense against that, and then it becomes an offense. And China hacking the United States is a direct result of the CIA trying to influence China. They're doing it because they have to. It's a defensive mechanism that has now turned offensive, because you can't just sit there and wait for somebody to hack you. You have to go out and determine what they're trying to do to you, and then it becomes offensive. So there's an international information war that has been, you know, promulgated basically by the United States, and everybody's reacting to it. I wrote the book Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. I suggest that you read that. And I heard Snowden talk recently. He was talking about the Vault 7 releases. And he's very good at putting things into perspective, because he worked there. I worked in the telecommunications and in two sides of this, designing secure telecommunications equipment. I did that for 10 years. I was a high-level systems engineer. That means a high-level design engineer in both hardware and software. I was not a programmer. We had hundreds of programmers working for us. But the point is, I understand this industry, and I saw the hacking come in, the entire secluded departments within telecommunications companies that caters to the hacking end or the eavesdropping end of telecommunications. It's everywhere. It's rampant. So everything you do, everything Trump did in Trump Tower, yeah, everything was hacked. But somewhere at a high level, someone took that information, released it to the New York Times and the Washington Post and the other release outlets, and Trump's conversations with the president of Mexico or Australia, these were released in the newspaper. And the newspaper said they had transcripts. In other words, they had the written text of the phone calls. So is this just against Trump? No, this is everybody. Did Obama directly authorize this? Well, let's just put it this way. He didn't stop it. Did he know about it? Well, of course he knows about it. Is he going to admit it? No. Is James Clapper? No. Is Comey, who is probably the prime suspect for the releases and the biggest traitor this country has ever seen, head of the FBI, is he going to admit it? No. He's just going to say he can't comment because it's in an ongoing investigation. But why would you have the guy who's probably the prime suspect in charge of the investigation? Anyway, enough of that. It's just that Washington, D.C. is a cauldron of scum, illegal activity, mainly centering around information gathering and the use of that information for counterintelligence, counteractivity against political enemies, etc. Just a comment on Obamacare and the attempt by Congress right now to cure it. Somebody asked me this question on John Moore's show yesterday morning. And really, until you cure the root problem, which is the vast expense in corporatization of medicine in the United States, you're not going to cure it by allowing everybody to have insurance. The easiest way to have everybody get insurance is just open up a group policy, have the companies, the independent companies, allow large-scale group policies because the poor individual is you know, behind the eight ball. You go in as an individual to get insurance, and I've known insurance agents that work for insurance companies paying vast premiums for their family insurance. So, and that's because they're buying it on an individual basis. Until you open it up and stop this idea that, say, somebody works for a company. Okay, well, they get a group policy. Isn't that swell because they work for a company? Well, what about the single mom that's living at home working a part-time job and the company doesn't offer insurance? Why should she be blocked from getting a group policy? Hey, we're the whole United States is a group. So what's the problem? And as much as I don't like Bill Clinton, he tried to attack this problem as in his presidency, and his mistake was turning it over to Hillary. But he was going to attack this problem, and his simple comment, I mean, like I say, I don't like Bill Clinton at all. But he did say one thing that was true, and that is at that time they were spending $2 trillion a year on medical treatment in the United States. That was in, what, early 90s. And he said there's enough money, so all we got to do is redirect this money so that everybody gets a piece of the pie. And, you know, of course, it never happens because the AMA and the pharmaceutical companies and the, you know, the corporate hospitals and the corporate ownership of doctors, you know, because the doctor sitting in his little office isn't going to do as well as if he's at a clinic because everybody goes to the clinic. So he's trapped in this. And also, a lot of people don't know that the doctor's last year of medical training is spent being hammered by pharmaceutical companies that are making him into a drug salesman, where the pharmacies should be the ones prescribing drugs. They're the experts in drugs. And a doctor, in a sense, his, you know, the most used, let me say this, the most used medical item in the world is the doctor's prescription pad. You cannot walk out of a medical office without a prescription. And at the end of the year, lo and behold, the doctor's biggest payment, not from you, the patient, the biggest payment the doctor gets all year is at the end of the year, his kickback from the medical from the pharmaceutical companies, because he prescribed their drug the most, or the most often, or whatever. He gets a kickback for every time he prescribes a drug. And so at the end of the year, that's the doctor's largest surge of money at the end of the year, is from his pharmaceutical cooperation. It's horrific. And so, number one, medicine simply costs too much. It, you know, the cancer treatments, for example, you know what, $13,000 for a chemo treatment? Come on, you're pouring chemical sludge into this person. It costs about $2. But this is the corruption within the medical industry. And until you cure that, you know, you can give people all the medical insurance they want, but it's not curing the problem. So, you know, putting Band-Aids on, you know, or Congress, I don't think the Republican plan to replace Obamacare is going to be any different. On the surface, what they're presenting is really kind of a, you know, a piece of cheese on a buttered piece of toast. You know, it's really not a big change. Anyway, I don't want to waste too much time on that. But you have to go down to the root problems in the United States and cure the problem at the root. I just saw an interesting thing. Science, there's a place you might want to go look at this. Some of my hardened, seasoned listeners would not be affected by this, but it's called Science News for Students. And the first thing they push is global warming. Then the dinosaurs, then black holes or dark matter. It's just a continuation of the standard science party line. And the question, I've been asked questions on radio shows recently, and I keep coming back to the fact that the American public, of all public in the world, I have had interesting conversations in Europe where I did my video, What the Japanese Really Want to Know About Planet X. And it turns out that other countries are not barraged by this insane policy of, you know, these standard talking points, the narrative of standard science in the United States. And the other thing is that people are not taught how to critically think about things. They're told that science is a list of facts, and they never really can quite get to the basis of where these so-called facts came from. And I know a lot of people are waking up. A lot of people come to my page when my introductory prologue to my page, it says a lot of people see about astronomy, read about it in the news and the periodicals, etc. And they're kind of aware that there's something wrong here, but they really don't know what. And so what I try and do is teach people how to critically think, how to analyze, and then I do something that literally nobody else does, and that is replace it with something sane. But anyway, I just want to comment that the attack on students to drum this ludicrous science into them and then not give them any reasoning capability over this, or to examine deeply what is behind, for example, the global warming claim or the global climate change, which is even more nebulous. Scientists today really don't do much data gathering. It's more computer modeling. It's sitting in their nice, clean office with their lab robe on or whatever and not getting their hands dirty. Let me explain what it would take to actually understand global warming. You would need sensors all over the globe, in the ocean, down in the ocean, on land, up high in the air. Here's something, here's an input that comes along every day and nobody even keeps track of. The wind. Where does the wind come from? Now, standard science says that it's due to the sunlight that comes in and somehow heats up the air and causes weather. Tornadoes, you know, regular wind, lightning and clouds, all of it completely ludicrous. No, the wind comes directly from electrical conditions that are in the solar system surrounding Earth and part of our discharge of the solar capacitor. So the upper-level jet streams are then connected electrically to the lower-level jet streams, and those are the ones that typically drive our weather. They're coupled with it. But that electrical energy coming in every day is part of our electrical balance. And that's energy that comes in every day. Nobody's calculating that into the global climate change equation. That's a lot of energy every day that they're not accounting for. They're not accounting for the fact that on a clear night, a desert can become the coldest place on the planet. The biggest temperature drop from day to night is on a dry desert. Or it could be in the winter when it's extremely dry because there's no vapor in the air. It's as dry in your house as the driest desert. It's actually drier. But the point is that heat content is not given into the global climate change equation at all. And so what you witness a lot of times if you have clouds, it's not the greenhouse effect, it's the fact that you have moisture in the air and higher heat content. A very simple chemical principle, but you never hear about that. And so what I'm saying is that the climatologists are lazy. They have not done sufficient homework. And so when they say, oh, the temperature rose and it's 0.2 degrees, let me tell you, they don't have enough data. They fudge the data, we know that. But they don't have enough data to make a clear-cut decision. I mean, the world does not have enough sensors, and it does not take into account all of the energy inputs that are coming, especially the electrical ones, and that's called joule heating. If you run an electrical current through something, it's going to cause heat, and that's not accounted for. Okay, so I'm spending a bit too much time on a couple of these topics. I have to move along. North Korea, rocket explodes on launch. I saw the launch and the explosion. We know that the military has the capability with laser and scalar-type weapons, beam weapons, to destroy rockets. They've done it on our own launch pads, for goodness sakes. And so the fact that North Korea's launch exploded on rocket exploded on launch is not a big surprise. And there should be no reason why anybody should be able to launch a rocket any place on the planet with the technology that's available today. So the only motivation would seem to be that they want to keep the narrative going that North Korea is a threat, when in reality it's not. The very interesting map just was placed in the public domain from Europe, from the European Space Agency. It's the lithospheric magnetic map of Earth. And it you can look this up on the internet. It shows the entry into the Earth and the leaving of the Earth of the magnetic field lines. The blues are the plus end of the magnet, and I think the reds are the negative, or I might have that reversed, but it's not the point. That the map shows 6% of the Earth's magnetic field is generated by geomagnetic sources. In other words, the fixed magnetic field. And I really never had a number on that before. I knew it was small. And I talk about this in my weather book. And I've defined way back in the early 2000s, I defined the five-layer magnetic field that surrounds Earth. And the very core of the Earth emits produces a magnetic field. It's probably due to an inherent magnetic field in the material that makes up the core. But only 6% of the Earth's magnetic field is due to lithospheric magnetic field, in other words, iron and nickel primarily, in the crust and mantle of the Earth. So only the rest, 94%, is from plasma sources, in other words, electric fields. And I'll just state these. Once again, I've said this many times. It's in my weather book. It's in my other work and lectures, etc. But the first layer of plasma magnetic field, in other words, not related to the geomagnetic field, is in the jet streams. We have an easterly moving jet stream in the northern hemisphere, one in the southern hemisphere. There are two around the North Pole, that in the South Pole, that they're not significant for the majority of us. And then there's the equatorial jet stream, the easterly moving ones around the temperate climates are positively charged. The westerly moving jet stream around the equator is primarily electrons, and these couple to create a magnetic field. They're coupled with the ionospheric layering of charge, and that's what is connected directly to the discharge of the solar capacitor, the electrical currents passing around Earth. Then we have the Van Allen belts. Then we have the overall protective layer magnetic field, where the sun's charged particles in the solar wind come in, and they sense the Earth's magnetic field. So the positive charges go one way, the negative charges go the other way. And once again, that adds to our overall plasma magnetic field. So those are the five plasma magnetic field layers above the geomagnetic field. But very interesting, only 6% of the Earth's magnetic field. So when you pick up a compass and you're trying to find due north, well, if you're right on one of these magnetic north magnetic lithospheric magnetic sources, then that's the direction you get. But during a solar storm, you can take your magnet, your compass, which has a little magnet on the tip, and that keeps it in the direction north. You can actually see it moving back and forth, and if it's a severe magnetic storm, you can see it moving wildly. Comet 67P in the news.
Okay, this is the title from space.com. It says, collapsing cliff caused Comet 67P's brilliant outburst. And just to remind you, Comet 67P is a comet that was visited by the Rosetta space mission from the European Space Agency. And they had a lander which landed on the comet, and I've reported on this many times before, but this story comes as one of those stories that they waited for a long time. And I want to read the title again, because this sounds very definitive. It says, collapsing cliff. In other words, from close range observations, they saw a cliff structure on the comet that collapsed. And then they're associating this with a brilliant outburst, which was seen at a distance. And the anyway, I'll read the first line of the article. It said, a cliff's collapse likely caused a bright outburst of gas and dust on Comet 67P in 2015. So in the very first sentence of the article, it went from it did to it likely did. And so anyway, it says, observations captured by the European Space Agency Rosetta spacecraft marked the first time that researchers have drawn a direct link. In other words, they inferred this, as happens many times. This is just beyond disgusting, because they did not observe this. They're only saying it because they believe in a model which is incorrect, and they're looking for anything to justify that model. Okay, so and this happened before. Let me take an example with the Deep Impact spacecraft. This was July, 2005. I don't remember the exact date, July 4th. But anyway, there was an impactor that crashed into the nucleus of Comet Vild 2, and they had a camera, and the whole thing was supposed to show water exploding out of the hole that this impactor made, and all that came out was dry dust. And from a distance, they saw at about the same time some brightening of the tail. So they made the association, and the brightening of the tail was water. But no water came out of the hole. So NASA says it conclusively determined
that water coming off the nucleus of the comet during the explosion caused this brightening of the tail. Totally, totally incorrect. Just a lie. But if you're someone like me, you can catch these nuances, but in all of the published articles, they talked about how the impactor caused this brightening of the comet. So that's the same thing here. And so here's, without reading the rest of this article, they had a cliff face that they were watching. It had a fissure in it. And between the dates of July 4th, they say, but they had seen this for much earlier, and the 20th of July, which was much after the brightening incident, they noticed that the cliff had fallen down, had broken away and crumbled, and they could see rock pieces at the bottom. And so then they inferred that, oh, that must have been associated with this brightening. And so they, once again, there was no direct evidence of anything coming off the nucleus, and they have these enhanced pictures of light, and it's all it is reflected light with some dust activity around the nucleus, and that's why you see these like rays. I showed a picture on my webpage of a building in New York City. Somebody caught it in a photo where the sun was reflecting off the building, and you could see these rays coming off in the photo. Well, was the building emitting water as would a comet? No, of course not. It was just the rays, and because it was accentuated in that direction, you could see these rays, and that's what they're doing. They're amplifying, they're photoshopping these photos and amplifying the light a million times to get this effect. And this is something they've done over and over again. So once again, a false announcement, a false association to try and prop up their dirty snowball comet model. The end result is, however, there's some good data that comes out of this from the geological side, in that they saw the shape of the nucleus is like a dumbbell, like you go to the health, gymnasium, and you pick up these dumbbells, and they're kind of rounded at the end, and then they got a little handle in the middle, and that's what the comet looks like, and it continues to be eaten away at this center area. But once again, this is the electron beam that's chewing away at this central region. We've seen other comet nucleus like this also, like the potato shape. Comet Halley's nucleus, other comets have had this similar shape. Okay, just this one, next story is over the top, and I have to read it. Let me see if I can pull this up. From a listener, it says, why American farmers are hacking their tractors with Ukrainian firmware. In other words, American farmers, and now this is a story about John Deere tractors, and so this is a warning. If you are a farmer, beware of John Deere. I'll read this just verbatim. Tractor owners across the country are reportedly hacking their John Deere tractors using firmware that's cracked in Eastern Europe and traded on inactive, on invite-only paid online forums. The reason is because John Deere and other manufacturers have made it impossible to perform unauthorized repair on farm equipment, which has obviously upset many farmers who see this as an attack on their sovereignty and quite possibly an existential threat to their livelihood if their tractor breaks down at an inopportune time, reports Jason Kobler via Motherboard. As is the case with modern day engineering vehicles, the mechanical problems experienced with the newer farming tractors are often remedied via software. From a report, it says, the nightmare scenario, and a fear I had heard expressed over and over again in talking with farmers, is that John Deere could remotely shut down a tractor and there wouldn't be anything a farmer could do about it. A license agreement between John Deere required farmers to sign in October forbids nearly all repair and modification to farming equipment and prevents farmers from suing for crop loss, lost profits, loss of goodwill, loss of use of equipment, etc., arising from the performance or non-performance of any aspect of the software. The agreement applies to anyone who turns the key or otherwise uses a John Deere tractor with embedded software. It means that only John Deere dealership and authorized repair shops can work on the newer tractors. If a farmer bought a tractor He should be able to do whatever he wants with it, says Kevin Kenny, a farmer and right to repair advocate in Nebraska. You want to replace a transmission and you take it to an independent mechanic. He can put in a new transmission, but the tractor cannot be driven out of the shop. John Deere charges $230 plus $130 an hour for a technician to drive out and plug in a connector into the USB port and authorize the part. What you've got is technicians running around here with cracked Ukrainian John Deere software that they bought off the black market. Anyway, that's over the top. That a farmer buys a tractor and he can't run it because of the software. John Deere controls this remotely. I mean, this is just over the top.
Just a quick commentary on illegal immigration. I'm a person that's lived much of my life in third world countries. And believe me, the cultures, just, you don't want a lot of those people in the United States. It's just a big problem. They're a problem where they are. And the vetting that goes on in the process of legalization of citizens for the United States, I've been on that side of it too. I've seen that with friends and people. It's there for a reason. And today's world is a little different than when the mass immigrations came in from, say, Europe, or my ancestors came from Ireland. It was a bit different because the United States was not what you'd call established in a lot of respects. But today, we have a population that we really cannot increase a lot more. The cities, they're at the breaking point. There's financial difficulties within the cities. But the other thing is the cultures in a lot of the countries where these people are coming from is not good. And the people that are coming across the border are really not the best people at all. In fact, they're just the opposite end of the spectrum. And you really don't want those people in the United States. And you can sit there in your, righteousness, saying how wonderful it is to help people out. But the reality is that those people are much easier to help in their own country. It's much cheaper. And the cost, the social cost. Now, you look at the things that are going on. Another issue is a lot of the crimes that are being committed are not being reported. There's a report I saw that 642,000 crimes had been committed by illegal aliens. This is over the top. I mean, it's just horrendous. And this is the kind of thing that goes on daily in third world countries. So you have to vet people. There's not enough room anymore in the United States for everybody to come there. And really, you don't want those people. So the vetting process is something, it's a sign of the times, and it's something that's extremely necessary. The number of victims is the number that are publicly known is relatively small to the number of victims who are being victimized every day. And so in that respect, I 100%, 110% support Trump in what he's doing to close the borders. And he's not saying, you can't let anybody in. He says you have to vet people. And the countries they're trying to stop in the Mideast, they're trying to get in to cause damage. And you have to understand that a lot of the people in Washington are behind that. They want to bring down the United States, and the way they do that is pitting societies one against the other because they're rising members of the New World Order, and they're not going to succeed in getting their New World Order in place unless they bring down the United States. It's as simple as that. Here's an interesting story. After all the hype that Mars has water, there was a story that hit the press maybe a year ago, and there were some cliff faces on Mars where they saw periodically some dribbling and it looked like water. Well, now they've determined that that was not water. So after all of the hype,
that they had discovered water on Mars. Now they're saying that, no, that was not water. And surprisingly, that article came in space.com also. So there, the whole issue of going to Mars, all of these people are going to Mars, NASA going to Mars, is ridiculous. Nobody's going to Mars, I can tell you that. But I just want to mention, Trump signed what is known as the Transition Authorization Act. And now, of all of the agencies that were cut, the EPA was cut by like 34%. I announced that on last week's show, and I talked about all the cuts in the major agencies, all the way down to the Department of Interior, which was the least cut at 11%. Trump only cut 2%, or the proposed budget, 2%, on one program that was to send a lander to Europa to find out if there was, you know, the Europa has water on it or ice. So they cut that program. I think that was $400 million. And then one other one, some kind of educational program, I believe. But here is what this means. The Transition Authorization Act, Trump is saying to NASA, I'm going to support you at nearly 100%. And so all of these glowing, happy faces of NASA representatives, a couple of astronauts are there. He wants to keep the manned space program and the manned mission to Mars program alive. But by the year 2024, which is only 6 years away, he wants NASA to transition to basically supporting itself through commercialization. In other words, NASA has to produce products, commercial products, that in fact have value, and private companies will come in and take over the $20 billion bill of NASA. So in other words, they got to produce. So this is going to be very interesting. But Trump did this, of course, as a political move, because NASA, unlike the other agencies, employs companies, small private contractors all over the country in all of the congressional districts, and they're, in a sense, they were made Congress-proof and now President-proof. Not even Trump can drain the swamp at NASA, because he would be cutting jobs, and they would come out and scream, well, Trump cut this and it cut jobs, and these poor people down here in southern Indiana lost their jobs because Trump. So anyway, he's locked in. And so he made a very wise political move. And now he's got to be political. He's in the political arena. And so he signed a bill. This is very interesting. This first time any president has ever done anything like this, to transition NASA into a private agency. So now the proof has got to be in the pudding. And so by the year 2024, NASA has to be financially independent. They have to compete in the real world. And I'm going to tell you something, they're not going to be able to. The people like Musk, they're come along, they have the engineers. I bet you how many good engineers probably left NASA to go work for Elon Musk. The good ones did. And so he's picking up steam. The only trouble is he's marching down the wrong road. But if he ever discovered that he was marching down the wrong road, it probably would not take him long to transition. Anyway, very interesting. Chuck Berry in the news. Remember Chuck Berry, the guitar guy, and Johnny B. Goode and all that? Well, his space music has been sent out in outer space twice now, they're saying. And one of them, Carl Sagan, did and chose the music that would go on the Voyager spacecraft. I guess it was a golden record that they put on there, the old vinyl type of, you know, foot in diameter record. And one of the songs, or a couple of the songs, were from Chuck Berry, who died recently, a couple days ago. So we all listened to Chuck Berry, I'm sure, over the years. But Chuck Berry, now music flying in outer space. And by the way, I don't agree with that, but if somebody finds a spacecraft, it's probably not going to take them more than a New York second to figure out where it came from. So it's not like we're giving away any great secrets. But now, I believe I announced this story on last week's show, and I want to go into some detail here. This is a scientific topic. NASA's new study claims that there are no electrons in the Earth's inner Van Allen radiation belt. And I want to make this tonight's main science topic, because after looking at this carefully, what they're claiming is that they are not seeing any electrons. And I'm going to explain what's going on here. And then you have Elon Musk standing up, and I thought this was actually funny. Elon Musk is, I consider him a smart guy, very good businessman, has signed his life away with the devil with the CIA and the funding he got from Google and Fidelity, etc. And so therefore, much of his success, as with Rihanna, the movie star, or all of the other Madonna or any of the other people, have made lots of money because they sold their soul to the devil. But here's Elon Musk in a video on a stage talking about space radiation. And I'm like, what? What does Elon Musk know about space radiation? And he really had it all wrong. So he's planning on sending two guys that claim they have two paying customers for 2018 to go in a space capsule from SpaceX company to go around the moon and come back to Earth. Now, this is totally untested hardware. They've never done anything like this before. But anyway, let me read a little bit of this article that's published for general public. This is in Science News, Science Daily. The source, Los Alamos National Laboratory, a place I've been at, Department of Energy. The inner Van Allen belt has less radiation than previously believed, according to a recent study. Observations from NASA's Van Allen probes show the fastest, most energetic electrons in the inner radiation belt are actually much rarer and harder to find than scientists expected. It says, this is good news for spacecraft that are orbiting in the region and can be damaged by high levels of radiation. And then they do some artist conceptions here, things like that. Here is what's going on. Now, if you understand my work in my weather book, I have defined, I'm sorry if there's a little bit of noise here, there's beyond my control, there's some little bit of construction work going on nearby. But here's what's going on. In my weather book, Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, I talk about the insertion of electrons and protons into the Van Allen belts, and it's a direct result of them coming in. They break through that magnetic shield that is out in front of us about 30,000 miles to the sunward side of Earth, and some of them get through. Not all of them are totally blocked. So those are the ones that are trapped, and especially the relativistic ones, the high-energy charged particles from the sun. And so those become trapped in the Van Allen belts. That's what the Van Allen belts are. They are in magnetic orbits around Earth. These are charged particles. So you have protons going one way, you have electrons going the other way. Okay. And there are belts. Primarily, the electrons are trapped in one. The protons are trapped in the other one. And they're co-rotating. And they're at different radii from the Earth because of their mass. And this is, let me describe a mass spectrometer, how it works. These are used many times in research. But anyway, you send charged particles into a device that's a closed chamber, and it has a magnetic field. And there are two factors in the orbit or the curved direction, the curvature of the path of the particle. One is the mass. The heavier the mass, the bigger the radius of curvature. Because it's more massive, it's going to take more force to bend it into a circle. So that's one factor. And the amount of charge. The more charge on it, the more magnetic force on the charged particle. So these are factors that affect charged particles in a mass spectrometer. And so at any rate, the particles in the Van Allen belt work the same way. The protons, being heavier mass by about 1960 times than the electrons, they have the same charge. So guess what? The protons rotate in the outer ring primarily. And the inner ring was typically for electrons, the same situation. You have a higher charge-to-mass ratio. So it's just an understanding of basic physics. And now they're saying they're not finding any electrons in the inner belt. And, of course, there's some mixing going on here because of the different energy levels. In other words, the different velocities of protons and electrons. They're not all moving at exactly the same velocity, but they're moving in counter in opposite directions because they have opposite charges. The proton has a positive charge. The electron has a negative charge. So anyway, they bend in different directions based on the magnetic force. Well, okay, that's some basic physics. So that's the explanation for the Van Allen belts. Now, in my work also, I explain that the sun is variable. And we are now, right now, at the very low ebb, and have been for a very long time, of solar activity. Just the other day, there was a G1 storm, which is just a mini little poof that came out of the sun. Spaceweather.com is treating that like that's the biggest thing since sliced bread. When we used to have M and X class flares all the time when Hale-Bopp was in the solar system, and the sun was exploding daily with M and X class flares, the highest level flares that are known on the sun. And so we don't have those anymore. And what's happened is after Hale-Bopp, it depleted the solar capacitor. It's building up slowly, but the solar electrical activity and solar wind activity is very minimal. And so now that NASA has put some satellites up into the Van Allen belts, they're getting a minimum number of electrons and saying, oh, there aren't as many electrons. It's going to be safe for space travel. How stupid. Once again, not understanding the process, going up and making some local measurements at the wrong time. And now this is going to be used to allow astronauts and spacefarers and tourists to go into space. And it's interesting because nobody's talking about the Apollo program and the fact that they supposedly went through the Van Allen radiation belts with not a problem at all back in the 60s. But that's another story. The second problem is even greater with their scientific result. And here's what it is. You have a proton belt, which is out farther, moving in one direction. You have the electron belt, inner belt, which is moving in the other direction. And here's what happens. That happens to be a battery, one of the 17 local electric batteries that I defined in my weather book. You can read about that. And here is what happens. When the spacecraft is maneuvering in this area, it's going to discharge that local capacitor. And what happens? Well, the electrons have higher mobility. This is standard plasma discharge comet model physics. And so the electrons move much faster to close the gap on the spacecraft. So they come to the spacecraft in higher numbers. They charge the spacecraft, just like a comet nucleus, up to a negative potential. And then the protons come in much more slowly to neutralize that charge. And so they're not going to see as many electrons. That doesn't mean there are less electrons. No, that just means that the spacecraft is charged up to a negative potential. And the protons are coming in, so they're seeing primarily protons. So they don't know what they're doing, is what I'm telling you. NASA is, well, they're a bunch of raving idiots, people running around with PhDs in baloney science that don't know what they're doing. And I've been inside Los Alamos National Laboratory. I've given lectures there to their top plasma physicists, and they walk out like they're stunned, like you just hit them with a stun gun. Because they don't know, this doesn't compute in their brain. Because it wasn't in their, you know, textbook when they got their PhD 20 years ago. They don't know what they're doing. And so as a result, they're going to send astronauts up into this area that are going to get seriously burned with X-ray. Because what happens when those X-rays, when the electrons are coming at the spacecraft, they're diverted and they cause what are called Bremsstrahlung X-rays. Bremsstrahlung means breaking. It's a German word. And that's what happens with comets. You can see those breaking electrons out there, out on the sunward side, and that's the X-ray signature that, and that's what my work predicted back in the late 1970s when I published my work and first did the theoretical development. I said, that's the key signature of the plasma discharge comet model. They were actually discovered in 1996. And of course, then came along and they said, oh, that's due to charge exchange. They didn't know what caused it at first. In fact, now I understand that the lead scientist on that, who is Casey Liss, Carrie Liss, I don't know what he calls himself anymore these days, but discovered this. And he said, these are Bremsstrahl lung X-rays. The guy's a good physicist. He's just kind of caught in the trap with his handler, Michael Muma. But they discovered my work. They discovered exactly the plasma discharge comet model signature. And then, of course, they couldn't talk about that because my work has been blackballed since I left Cornell in 1981. And they really cannot touch this with a 10-foot pole because it's much bigger than just a comet theory. There's a lot more to this. But anyway, the end result is that the scientists at Los Alamos simply don't know what they're doing. So they're making a false determination, and they're going to send astronauts into the Van Allen belts. Well, they're going to find out the hard way. And then you got Elon Musk up on the podium talking about how radiation really isn't a big problem at all. And all of this supports this narrative that they're going to send people to Mars, they're going to send people around the moon and bring them back, etc. And it's, well, if they really do, here's my guess, though. None of these people are going anywhere. It's all going to be faked, and nobody's going anywhere. It's just a way for NASA to keep getting its funding, but NASA is going to have to keep getting its funding from private sources. So eventually, it's going to have to put some butter on the bread. Let's put it that way. They're going to have to, the rubber's going to have to meet the road. And so their little space vest, what I call the magic space vest, all the things that are going on relative to radiation in outer space today are just ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. And anyway, it just makes me crazy to even think about this. Just a couple announcements here. My paid cast for this week is going to be in the Radiation and You series, and I'm going to divide it between two topics. One is the Fukushima update. I mean, this is just horrendous, over the top, where the Fukushima reactor that melted down, that blew up and then melted down, or was blown up, I should say, and then is now melting down into China syndrome, is a disaster, absolute disaster. And, you know, I got to say something. Trump is surrounded by people who are the old guard. And I'm afraid we're in for some serious disasters here, including Fukushima. I don't know if he's even aware of this. They're so caught up in the mire of Washington politics that, in fact, the major issues of the world, water, energy, radiation, things like this, are completely going over the top. The other half of that special, I'll be talking about this, I'll be continuing this discussion about space radiation and underestimating the effects of space radiation. So it'll be a tool topic program. And there's another topic that I'm bringing up that's going to be included as an extra. It'll probably be posted in the next number of days. I hope to get this done. But it's a program I developed. It'll be included in the paid cast. It's called Building Noah's Ark. So basically, it's a program I developed. It's a design and a actually explaining how Noah built the ark physically. In other words, after you listen to this, if you were sufficiently good at working with wood, you could go out and build an ark with the same technique. Now, I spent some time down in the Caribbean in my life, in fact, quite a bit of time. I've owned sailboats, wooden sailboats. I owned a wooden fishing boat down there, which I reconditioned. And so I also studied the construction and in my own time became the equivalent of a naval architect in wood boat design. And so actually wrote some articles, some things like that. At any rate, So I learned about wooden boat building, and that's what Noah did. He built a big wooden boat. So I'm going to go through the details, and once you see this, you're going to recognize that that's in fact how Noah built the ark. Now, let's just put it into perspective. This is a big boat, it's a couple hundred feet long, and deep and heavy, and of course it would have a big ballast. It carried all of the animals, etc., and was built to take heavy weather. And so anyway, I'll go into detail about the construction technique, the woods used, and the type of woods, and the building construction, etc. And he had Noah worked with his two sons. So how would three people build this 200-foot boat? Well, it took them a while. But when you see the process, and I've seen this process used, and I've used it myself, then you're going to understand how Noah built the ark. And so this is a process that's historically very ancient. It was used by shipwrights throughout the ages, and it's very sturdy, a very sturdy method of building a boat. When you get done, it's really like one piece, and I'll explain how that happens. So once again, if you're not a member of the paid cast, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and just join the paid cast, $3.95 a month. And How to Build the Noah's Ark is an extra episode, let's put it that way. And by the way, you may want to pay attention to last week's paid cast, where it was in the Cosmos series, The Real Story. But I take on evolution, and I really dive into it in a scientific sense. Not an emotional sense, not a evolution versus creationism, but in the real scientific sense. And you're going to be surprised at the conclusions I come to, showing that evolution is really a flawed, an extremely flawed concept, and it has been since the very beginning. So that's what last week's paid cast, something you definitely want to listen to. Also, I should mention on this week's paid cast, I'll be talking about water, radiation in your water. So there's actually three topics somewhat mixed together. And of course, the Fukushima event is dumping radiation into the water system all around the world. Horrific disaster. And then now they're trying to cover this up, talking about the death of reefs as some kind of, all of a sudden, it's a natural event. For thousands of years, millions of years, these great reefs have existed, and all of a sudden they're starting to die off, and they're just, oh, it's just like the die-off of reefs is normal now. It's the new normal. Anyway, and also remember my water filters, the best water filters on the planet, the most complete line of water filters, the inline on-demand filters, the above sink, the below sink, the stainless steel, the large water plastic filters, and my personal travel sport water filters, nothing like them on the market at all. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.